Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the IL Preps Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Ty Zanders. Ty, it's good to have you back. The November recruiting window is around the corner, but first we're going to start talking about the first 50 days of recruiting for the class of 2021. You have unveiled three pieces of content this week, starting with a by-the-numbers analysis, and then you analyzed the top face-off guys and goalies, the power 100 or the top 100 face-off guys and goalies who have already committed, which is all of them. And then on Friday dropped the top 50 long sticks. So first, like I said, let's start by talking about the by the numbers. You really dove into the 159 verbal commitments in the class of 2021 since, but between September 1st and October 20th. What did you learn? What'd you take away?
Yeah, I mean, first off, it was, kind of uncharted territory in many ways, you know, kind of diving into an Excel spreadsheet and graphs and all that data. So it was an enjoyable process and got to tip my hat to Patrick McEwen, our data specialist, for kind of helping me out and, get my feet wet with Excel and pretty pleased with what we came up with. And, I think the biggest thing was, to me, it was two things, really. It was that 42 commitments happened in 11 days, you know, which is pretty substantial. And that was between September 22nd and October 1st. And that was after 33 commitments happened in 3 weeks to start off September. And then, you know, the other was, if you look at week seven of the graph, which, you know, does include an extra day, you know, the 20th, but just a huge spike in commitments from other recruits, you know, which is to say non-4-star and 5-star recruits and some very talented players in there for sure. But what you can, you know, kind of take away from that is, you know, per usual, the top players set the process in recruiting and kind of dictate the tempo and the way that all these schools handle things. And, you can definitely, you know, see that there, that big spike in 4- and 5-star commitments in week 5 and 6, and subsequently that huge, you know, trend of, you know, all the recruits to commit to schools. You know, I mean, it was 23 in week 7.
So what that really said is that, you know, while guys may have, and by guys, I'm referring to college recruiters, might have been targeting some of the same players and were hopeful and unready to move on until those guys committed, it wasn't until after they committed when ultimately they felt comfortable moving forward with the next group on their list. And one of the, you know, you parsed out this information in a number of different ways. You broke it down by college class in terms of number of top 100 recruits that had committed since September 1st. Johns Hopkins leading the way with 6, and they're really an indication of this phenomenon that you're talking about, because I think early in September, you know, there was some concern about what kind of class the Blue Jays would be able to put together, and it came together really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like, you know, Coach Petro and his staff, and they should be, you know, pretty pleased with what they've put together. And, you know, the big thing there is just really bolstering the defensive, class. I don't feel as though they have a great group in the 2020 class, defensively, that is. Offensively, they're fantastic. And I think that, you know, with that said, I think Hopkins went out and got three top 25 players, you know, between Andy Demopoulos, a goalie from Darien, the Eclipse program. JoJo Todaro was a big one we mentioned that flipped from Syracuse, and then Jay Cohen from Landon and DC Express. Todaro playing for Icon. So that was a substantial haul that I think, you know, sent a message. You know, they wanted to really shore up the back line and, you know, a really good group there. But it's interesting to see Hopkins and Carolina, you know, combining for 11 commitments, you know, in those 50 days from top 100 players alone, given that they were, you know, in many ways the leaders of, you know, the early recruiting, you know, movement, along with a few others. But I love what those two schools have put together so far. And, you know, I think they've combined overall for maybe 14 commitments. 14 commitments from top 100 players, you know, also including kids that committed beforehand. But yeah, it's interesting to see the schools that were the early recruiters, you know, still gobble up a talent, you know, first. Although I will say, I do not think that you can call this early recruiting, even though some people probably will. You know, I feel like this is just the perfect time for all of it. It's been fun to analyze those first 50 days and kind of, you know, even more enjoyable to revisit after 100 days.
So we talked at length about the different class breakdowns last week, so I don't think we need to spend a ton more time on that. If you want to hear, go check it out in the Inside Lacrosse podcast archives. That being said, you also broke down by conference the overall commitments that each conference had gotten, and I think there were a couple of interesting takeaways there. You know, first and foremost, the total number of commitments in order goes 33 to the Big Ten, leading the way, 31 to the Patriot League, 29 to the Ivy League, 17 to the ACC and Big East, respectively. And, you know, there's basically one kind of overarching thought that I have, given that, you know, kind of top five ranking, so to speak. And it's the ACC teams have not been incredibly aggressive in the first 50 days relative to the role that I think they were perceived to have played in the development of early recruiting. And really, when you remove, as you mentioned, Carolina from that group, that means that the remaining four schools only combined to take 12 commitments, three per, which is actually on an average basis less than the Patriot League commitments, you know, because that's one of the things, right? It's not a surprise that the Patriot League has taken so many commitments. There are nine programs. But on a per school basis, the Patriot League programs have taken 3.4 commitments per school. ACC schools, once you remove Carolina, are at three. So that's a pretty dramatic and interesting takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, that's wild to consider. I mean, I'm just looking at what's happened in the weeks, you know, in the weeks since this article went up. You know, the Patriot League added two more and the Big Ten added one. So it's 34 and 33. But yeah, you do have to take the Patriot League number with a grain of salt, you know, given, you know, the volume of schools in that league. But they have done a really good job. You know, I think in general, yeah, with the ACC, it has been a little bit surprising. You know, I'm not surprised to see the activity from Carolina and Virginia. Notre Dame's done a really good job. Duke and Syracuse, you know, haven't really done a ton. And I will say, you know, they'll be fine. But you can definitely tell that other schools have been more active, you know, from a recruiting standpoint. But yeah, I mean, the trend is fascinating. I think that regarding the Ivy League,
well, hold on. I actually have a comment there. So let me just frame it, which is when the September 1st junior year date went into effect, I heard from a lot of quote-unquote mid-major programs coaches lamenting the idea of, number one, basically their comment was like, all the big guys are going to get all the best recruits because now that they're protected from themselves by taking players too early who don't blossom or don't turn into what they were projected to turn into, you know, we're not going to have the advantage that we have had over the last 5+ years of, you know, taking all the late guys who couldn't find a home elsewhere and getting those late bloomers. The other thing that you heard was, because these juniors in high school are all going to be unleashed on the landscape at the same time, and that time is football season, these big programs that can host visits during football games have such a leg up. However, and I suppose you could make the argument that it's come to fruition given that the Big Ten has gotten 20 of the top 100 recruits who have committed. That being said, the Ivy League has 16, meaning that they can't market that big football school opportunity. What do you make of that? Because for me, you know, it says that the balance of power hasn't shifted that dramatically just to the big football schools.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. And I think, you know, in terms of the Ivy League, I think it's certainly advantageous for them to have that extra time to look at these kids' grades. You know, I mean, you know, you've had four semesters, you know, of grades to look at, and kids are starting to take their SATs. And I think that's definitely, you know, a reason why the Ivy Leagues have been able to be aggressive and felt more comfortable, you know, with the recruiting timeline. But going back to the Big Ten, yeah, I mean, the football, you know, the advantage of having football and these incredible environments like Ohio State or Penn State or Michigan, you know, is certainly, you know, beneficial to any school's recruiting situation. And, you know, with that, and I said this to you recently, you know, what I wanted to see is how well they did, you know, from those visits. And I mean that, you know, more so like my thought is, you know, in the early recruiting era, there, I feel like a 13 or a 14, 15 year old would just be totally enamored, you know, being in the field and warm ups, you know, at one of those 100,000, you know, stadiums. And I feel like that may not be the case as much, you know, for a 16 year old going through the process. But if you look at, you know, what that conference has become, and you know how competitive and you know on TV to watch that and the success of these programs, I think that like any kid's going to want to play at one of those schools, and I think it's become, you know, things have shifted a little bit where the Big Ten has, you know, arguably become the best conference in lacrosse. And I think that, you know, kids are finding that attractive, you know, relative to the ACC that have done so well in recruiting in the past.
So the last thing that you parsed out were commitments by club, and you listed out the I believe top 10, maybe top 12 in terms of leaders in terms of players who have committed the most. And West Coast Stars leads the way with 10 commitments, DC Express in second with 8, Igloo and Team 91 tied with 7, and then I think 7 or 8 all tied with 6. The West Coast Stars revelation is interesting to me because one of the other reactions that we heard to the recruiting rule changes is that it was going to be a significant disadvantage to out-of-market players, guys who lived, you know, not within easy driving distance of all these potential destinations, because, you know, it was going to make it more onerous for them to take these visits. So the fact that they are the first off the board, I don't know. I don't know what it says other than, you know, maybe that initial alarm was, you know, maybe it was a little mistaken. But on the other hand, it says maybe this is reinforcing that comment because, you know, these guys are making commitments to lock up spots because they just don't want to fly across the country and take more visits. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, like it is tough to, you know, be a West Coast recruit, you know, a West Coast lacrosse player that has the hopes of playing college lacrosse, because you're flying east all summer in November. And then, you know, for prospect days and visits. So, you know, you're racking up the airline miles, but it's tough to pull off. And I think, you know, with that said, you know, what I've gathered and you know, we'll always speculate is that I just feel like they're more focused. You know, the recruitment for the West Coast kids, the top ones, it's a bit more focused. They kind of have a, you know, they'll play the game and they'll listen to different pitches and all the, you know, the calls that came up, but they kind of narrow it down and quickly have a good sense of where they want to go and, you know, may visit three schools in 3 days. You know, I mean, as you said, it's tough, especially given the fact that, you know, a lot of these kids may play football. So it's not like you can just play a Friday night game and hop on a plane and, you know, you're there on spending Saturday there. You know, I think that that's what maybe a kid in Baltimore can do, you know, head to Maryland or Penn State or Virginia or wherever, Hopkins, you know, right after a game and do a visit. So, you know, for the West Coast Stars to really, you know, crush it with this 21 class, you know, in those first 50 days. And that's on top of having, you know, two kids that were announced on September 1st in Wells Bly and Christian Rasmussen from St. Ignatius and Torrey Pines. They will go to Brown after PG year. They're 20s right now. I mean, that's a big time haul, and there are a couple on top there. But with that group, I mean, it's probably the best that the West has had. If you look at, you know, Matt Nunes, Owen Gaffney, Paul Barton, Dewey Egan, Cody Hart, Jackson Gray, Lake Baker, and Ben Ramsey. I mean, those are all top 100 players that have decided. And, you know, they're getting really, you know, really good scholarship offers. And they're going to tremendous schools. I mean, Carolina, Virginia, you know, Penn State, Notre Dame, you know, Harvard. So it's impressive, you know, what John Ozissi has going with the West Coast Stars. And on top of that, I mean, you know, DC Express and Igloo definitely stand out as two clubs have done a really good job. Igloo having, you know, two prior commitments to Michigan and Air Force that happened before September 1st. So it's definitely, you know, cool to look at the breakdown, you know, by club.
So shifting gears and moving on to the other two components of this package that have already dropped, and the midfielders and attackmen are forthcoming. I mentioned what I think is probably the most significant takeaway from analyzing the faceoff guys and goalies in the class of 2021, which is that there are none left in the top 100 that are uncommitted. It's not a shock in the sense that, you know, these are highly sought after commodities, in the sense that you know, you're probably only going to take one in a class, so you're probably going to be very focused in your recruitment. You're also going to be very quick, because once maybe your first choice comes off the board, you're probably going to move really quickly on your second choice. And that's probably a big part of the reason that these dominoes fell so quickly. How else did you react to analyzing this group of players?
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way. I think that, you know, you do kind of have like the pecking order that you have, and the dominoes happen really quick. I mean, I know that a lot of these kids, from talking to club coaches, I got the sense that a lot of them were in the mix of the same schools. And, you know, one would surprisingly go off the board, and a kid would be, you know, thought that he'd have that his destination almost wrapped up. And then it's like, okay, no, I guess I'm going, you know, I'm going to go visit somewhere else now, you know, since they didn't take me. And I think that that's it's certainly surprising to me to see all this face-off activity, because that is a position, along with the attackman in the 21 class, that college coaches were most skeptical of. And I mean, I'm even looking at my rankings and you know, ripping it apart in a sense, because it was so difficult to differentiate a lot of these face-off guys. I mean, it was Chase Mullins, you know, who committed to Maryland, a five-star, you know, went off the board 2 weeks in, and then everybody else. You know, Will Lynch, I think, was the first one after that. He's going to Notre Dame. But it was very difficult to kind of, you know, figure out the order of these face-off guys. And there's certainly some very talented face-off guys that are four-stars and kids that, you know, maybe are waiting to break out this fall or moving forward that I haven't watched or coaches haven't watched. But it's not a tremendous face-off class, you know, but you know, a little surprised to see all that activity, you know, with that position.
Well, the thing that I had heard about it was, I think it was more about the unknown, and it was really a function of, because the position has such a strong temptation of evaluating one versus one, what had happened was there was almost a championship belt type effect where it was like, oh my God, this kid's the best. And then somebody would beat him. And then somebody else would beat him. And then somebody else would beat him. And so, you know, the guy who two seasons ago was considered to be the best now is, you know, five people removed from being the championship belt holder. So it's possible, you know, there's one interpretation that when you compare these to other grad years, it could be a good year at faceoff guy. It's just that you're not going to necessarily see it until they're juniors and seniors in college, when all of a sudden, you know, they're kind of dominating the group alone. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. And I think in general, I mean, it was a wait and see position, but, you know, it didn't turn out to be, but that's what people speculated, that it would be a wait and see position that people wanted to evaluate in November and then make decisions.
So what were your takeaways when you dove deep into the long sticks?
Yeah, I mean, well, first going backwards to the goalies, the goalie class is, you know, one of the deeper, you know, classes of goalies that I can remember. I mean, perhaps the most talent laden, you know, goalie class that I can remember in my 11 years doing this. Really, really good group, especially the top between Matt Nunes, Jack Fracchione, and Andy Demopoulos. And then, you know, Adam Norris was the other one in the top 100. He's going to Air Force. So really good goalie group, really good four-star goalie group, and a position that I think coaches felt really good about. And also, you know, as we've discussed in the past, I think probably gave a few more scholarship dollars to the top guys than maybe they did in the 20 class, which was a weaker goalie group. But defensively, I mean, going right from the goalies into D guys, the D class is stellar. I mean, it's deep, it's athletic. You know, there's versatility, there's talent at the top, and several D guys are still uncommitted, at least from a five star perspective. So, I mean, my general takeaways were, I mean, I felt this way during the rankings process, but the kids from Maryland and Long Island were really, you know, highly sought after. And I think it's, you know, you want an athlete, you want size, and you had that with maybe a kid like, you know, Paul Barton, from Sacred Heart Prep, Advance, and West Coast Stars from a club, you know, for his clubs. And then, you know, maybe a kid like Colin Mulshine. I look at the two of them in a very similar light in terms of being, I'm not going to say raw, but maybe not as refined as the others, and just getting better and better as time, you know, progresses. But I love this D group, and you know, I'll have more in the coming days on the players ranked 51 to 100 and some of the four stars as well, because there's a lot of defensemen in this class that stand out.
All right, Ty. Well, before we get into some of the recent commitment news over the course of the last week or so, you travel a fair amount, right?
I do indeed.
What's your go-to travel outfit?
Probably what I'm wearing right now. My favorite comfy sweatpants made by
Public Rec.
No comment.
Yes. So you actually teed me up for that too perfectly. So you know that I recently took a transatlantic flight, and I got a pair of Public Recs right before I took off. They're everyday pant, and so I got it in khaki because I'm a khaki pant wearing type of guy, as you are. I think you were like, you know, how old were you when you got your first pair of jeans? Like 25?
26.
Wow. Yeah. So that's a conversation for another time. but you know, I was like, all right, well, you know, I'll be wearing sweatpants, but I'll be looking classy. And I got to say, when I touched down in London, I felt like it was a brand new day, because these pants were, they were fresh, they were unwrinkled, which, you know, is a uncommon look for me. And it, you know, I can't speak to the rest of my outfit, but the pants were definitely in the right shape. So with that, I want to tell you guys a little bit more about Public Rec. Like I said, they're sweatpants that look like dress pants. They come with waist and inseam sizing, so you're not just getting small, medium, or extra large. Whether you're short, tall, somewhere in between, you can find a pair that fits exactly the way they're supposed to. The design details, like the elastic waistband with the drawstring, the two deep front zipper pockets, which are really nice, particularly if you're walking around a place where you're worried about getting your pocket picked, which I was in a couple of instances. It gave me some peace of mind in terms of making sure that I made it back to my hotel with my cell phone. Like I said, perfect for traveling, perfect for walking around, perfect for touring, perfect for trying to look good when you also want to be comfortable. They come in 9 colors, and like I said, I went with khaki, but there are a lot of other options available. They are the all-day, everyday pant for a reason, and that is Public Rec. And right now, you can get an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Go to publicrec.com/lacrosse today and get 10% off your first pair of their all-day, everyday pants automatically applied at checkout. Always free with U.S. shipping and free returns. Don't sleep on this rare opportunity to get a discount, although I will say that you'll enjoy sleeping in your Public Rec pants because they are that comfortable. That's publicrec, spelled REC.com/lacrosse for 10% off.
10% for listeners. I mean, what about, you know, for podcasters?
Yeah,
I mean, because I like comfort like anybody, and I like, you know, I like sweatpants and comfy khakis. So, you know, I'm intrigued. Maybe an increased discount for, you know, the podcasters themselves.
You drive a hard bargain. I'm sure we can figure something out. Like I said, I wanted to talk about some of the big recent commitment news. We're going to start in the class of 2020, where we are approaching National Signing Week. And last week we talked about the potentially biggest flip in the senior class. We're talking about Owen Hilt's decision to go to Syracuse. He had previously been committed to Denver. But this week, number 39 midfielder Colin Riley, a 2020 from Avon Old Farms, who plays with Legacy, had previously been committed to Penn State, is now going to go to North Carolina. Ty, what does this mean?
Yeah, I mean, this was an interesting one that to me kind of came out of left field and happened, you know, after the whole Hiltz ordeal, you know, knowing that Hiltz, you know, a lefty, was looking at Carolina, visited Carolina before publicizing his Syracuse commitment. Riley is awesome. I mean, just flat out, he's excellent. And he committed to Penn State, I think back in 2016, you know, or it's been a while, you know, and he's a Long Island kid who has been at Avon Old Farms in New England and, you know, is just excellent as a Dodger, as an initiator, left-handed, just goes really hard to the cage and has like one of the prettier releases that I've seen from an outside shooter, just hides the ball perfectly and just gets it out in the you know, the blink of an eye. I mean, he's awesome as a shooter on the run, and he did a really good job this summer and really just turned some heads at the U19 USA tryouts and made the cut to the top 50 game. And pulled a trigger in Carolina and definitely a big ripple effect there. And the Tar Heels are putting together a really good class of middies, for 2020s between, Riley and Cole Herbert in particular.
We've talked about some of the potential other outcomes as far as the Tar Heels are concerned, specifically Xavier Arline and the prospect of him playing football or potentially playing football and lacrosse somewhere other than North Carolina. Do you read into this decision that way at all?
I do. I do. I think that probably influenced, Carolina's decision to just, have other options. And, that is to say that they want Xavier, I'm sure. I mean, who wouldn't? It's apparent that, Arline is incredibly interested in playing football or both. And that may not be at Carolina. And that's what, and this is almost worth the podcast in itself. And we'll, go deeper into it as we lead, as we head into National Letter of Intent Week in a few weeks. But, the process is just to have different timelines, So, I wouldn't imagine that Arline will send in a letter of intent to Carolina and just wait, wait it out and see what happens and kind of, ponder his options. But I definitely look at this as something like, we've got to put together a great class if we lose Arline and potentially another, whether it's for football or grades or whatever it is, because it's just something that you kind of have to be prepared for. And, Carolina has been through it before, with football recruits and particularly Ricky Miazon, who was number one in the rankings a couple of years ago and now playing linebacker at Stanford. I mean, it's one of those things that, you want your best guy to come to, come to your school. But when you lose like a top five, top 10 player overall, whatever you want to call it, a five star, it does open up a lot of, scholarship dollars. And, that's not fully, it's not open because of Arline. But, I think they had some wiggle room to make some moves.
And then on the other end, Penn State. This is a program coming off of a Final Four appearance. I think they would classify as the team of the year in the sense that they were number one for 9 weeks. They played an incredible brand of offense. By some metrics, the best offense in the history of lacrosse.
Crazy.
Grant Amend and Mac O'Keefe are challenging record books, respectively, as maybe the best feeder or most efficient feeder and the most efficient shooter in the history of college lacrosse. They have a very rightful claim at being number one heading into the 2020 season. This is the sixth member of the class of 2020 who or at one point was committed and is no longer going to end up in Happy Valley, but it hasn't necessarily affected their recruiting overall in the sense that they've put together a really nice class in 2021. So what to make of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely noticeable. And, also, I mean, if you think about it, they lost Brendan O'Neill and Jackson Bonnets, and that's, that's a pair of five stars, right there. And then, losing Riley, I think hurt, losing Mikey Prestipino, hurt. They also, lost Champ Doyle and Ryan Sheehan, but it is one of those things that because of, the way that I feel about their class in the, the freshman class right now, they're 19s and they're 21s. I mean, they have five or six, top 100 kids. They're going to be just fine, and I said the same about, Syracuse and Duke, so I apologize. But, I mean, Penn State will ride the momentum from that Final Four appearance and a tremendous year into the 21s and 22s. And, they'll really fare, just fine. And we've seen that Jeff Tambroni and his staff have done a really good job with kids that may not be as heralded, but really do a good job developing them. But, that's probably, one of the main storylines of the fall And of this class in general, the top classes is Penn State's, you know, 6 losses.
And to that end, they still do have 5 4-star players in the 20 class. They only have 8 recruits overall. It suggests maybe they have an opportunity to make a splash or two late. You think that is a potential opportunity or potential outcome?
I do. I mean, I can see, you know, Penn State, you know, Virginia. You know, a few more schools. Yeah, I mean, Penn State, Virginia, Carolina, maybe Ohio State, add some 20s. I mean, I know, I think Maryland added, Maryland added a 20 recently, Grant Hanson, who was formerly committed to Princeton. So we've seen a lot of activities the last few weeks. And I mean, Yale, Harvard, some more schools looking to add 20s potentially, that I've heard rumblings about. So it could be a pretty fun next few weeks of potential flips.
Well, so keep the eyes peeled for Isle Preps and Ty Zanders on Twitter for all the latest news there. Make sure to check out insidelacrosse.com/recruiting for the latest commitments as well. And if you're a club coach, if you're a parent, if you're a player, make sure you know that you can report a commitment through insidelacrosse.com/recruiting as well. Moving on to the 2021 commitment news, these are guys that essentially fall kind of outside of that first 50 days window since we recorded last Friday. So unless you committed on Saturday or Sunday, you weren't included in that. But I want to start, you know, we could go chronologically, we could go in order of ranking, and I do want to start with what I think was the most newsworthy news of the week. Griffin Schutz, number 8 player in the class. He can play attacking and play midfield. He's from Deerfield. He plays for 3D New England. He had been committed to Boston University prior to the rule change. He was one of those 6 publicly known commits prior to the rule change, and he decided on Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, that was a huge win, you know, for the Wahoos, and that's, they've been doing a whole lot of that, both recruiting and on field these last few months. But with Schutz, I mean, you're getting a kid that physically looks a lot like Dylan Malloy, which is what that's, you know, who that staff had, you know, lead them to the Final Four, win it to Wharton, you know, in their final year before coming down to Charlottesville. So Schutz, this is huge for them. I mean, this is someone you can kind of, you know, build an offense around in a sense. And I think that, I mean, I said to a lot of guys this summer that I almost liked him better, you know, coming out of the box and dodging, you know, downhill like he did for the Big Green during the spring season. But in my mind, he's undoubtedly an attackman and has, you know, has some aspects of definitely some aspects of Dylan Malloy in his game, but also, like, I mean, moves really, really well and kind of creates like a Matt Moore, you know, almost. So it's big for them, and that's 3 top 10 kids. But with Schutz, like, I honestly think that if he did not commit to Virginia, that he would stay, you know, on board with Boston University. I mean, he had a very good visit there from what I gathered in the last few weeks. And love that staff, had some really meaningful relationships with those guys, you know, felt like the pull to Virginia was too strong.
So it's interesting to consider, when I first heard of this, I had what I think a lot of fans who are not specifically Cavalier fans had, which is the rich get richer. But your comparison to Dylan Malloy is interesting insofar as the – when you look at their 20 and the rest of their 21 class, I guess my question is, do they, from an offensive player standpoint, in their 20 group, they've got 3 attackmen in Mikey Hermer, Patrick McIntosh, and Russell Marr, and then 2 midfielders in Connell Kumar and Jack Walsh. What type of room do you think there is for Schutz to contribute early in his career?
I mean, a lot. I mean, he's the type of talent that you've got to have on the field because he does have that size and physicality. And I mean, I don't want to say like deceptive athleticism, but in some ways, like, I guess it's just to say that he moves impeccably for a kid of that size. And I felt the same way about, you know, Dewey Egan, who's going to Carolina. You know, that was very noticeable. But for Schutz, I think that he slides right in there on the attack, and I think that there's a lot of potential for someone like Russell Marr in the 20 class to run midfield. And as we know, I mean, it's all interchangeable, but they will find a spot, you know, for Schutz, and I see him being, you know, a really good attackman there. Probably more so maybe that second or third option, but, I mean, as we've seen, I mean, the second or third option at Virginia on their attack is, you know, awfully productive. You know, so it's a good spot to be in. I think that, you know, Sean Kerwin, you know, I mean, this is exactly the kind of guy that he wants in Charlottesville.
Moving on, another attackman made his decision this week. Number 28, Ben Smith, an attackman from Boys Latin in place for Crabs, is going to Penn.
Yeah, Ben Smith is you know, been a mainstay of that Laker attack the last 2 years. I mean, it's one thing to make a varsity roster, you know, in that league, and it's another to, you know, start, you know, and flourish, which is what he's done. I mean, he's put up some big time numbers to Lakers. You know, really good creator. I mean, not just like not super quick, but I mean, it just has a great feel for the game, great vision, game sense. You know, really doesn't force too many things, and he kind of did that a little bit at some events this summer. But if you watch him, you know, he plays with. He just plays under control and with poise, and I think that's a really big addition, you know, for the Quakers and Mike Murphy to add Smith and surround him with someone like Jeff Riccardelli and Tynan Walsh. I mean, that's three top 40 attackmen with Walsh, you know, often playing midfield. That's a really good group, you know, for Penn. And we talked about Penn State kind of riding, you know, the wave of a strong season. Penn has certainly done that, you know, with their group. I mean, also adding Ethan Till, who we broke down, you know, in today's piece, you know, on InsideLacrosse.com. But I love that group for Penn, and that's a huge addition for them.
A pair of top 100 faceoff guys going to the Patriot League. We had Blake Burchill making his decision to go to Bucknell. He was ranked 88th in the class from Brunswick, who plays for Eclipse. In addition to that, we had Chris Kappelman, the number 63 ranked player in the class from Long Island, going to Navy.
Yeah, and they're both just wildly athletic, and that's one of the first things. It's the hand speed and the kind of athletes those two are. Played really significant roles, you know, for their high school team, as sophomores, you know, alongside, I mean, for St. Anthony's and Kappelman, you had Jake Naso in front, and then for Brunswick, in front of Burchill, you had Kobe Ginder. So, you know, they've definitely, you know, been battle-tested against great competition and worked alongside, you know, stellar face-off guys in the 20 class. And that kind of, you know, got them to the point. You got them to Navy and Bucknell. And those are two huge gets. I mean, they had their fair share of interest. But two really impressive, you know, face-off guys that can do a lot more than face-off, which is generally the theme of this group, you know, as highlighted in that article yesterday.
We mentioned the Blue Jays earlier in the podcast, but they picked up a big commitment out of Philadelphia with Will Peden, an attackman for Malvern Prep and Mesa. He is the number 56th ranked player in the class.
I'm a big fan of Peden. I'd not really seen a whole lot of him until I went up to the Interact Championship, you know, in May, and he was stellar. I think he had three or four assists and was just, you know, really, really playing well and like a senior. I mean, I like him a lot, and I think that he may, you know, you can joke about it. I mean, he's a little guy, and I think that's, you know, been a theme of Hopkins is not having like these big, strong, you know, alley dodgers that he used to have, but just crazy skill and IQ. You know, they've had a lot of that, and Peden, you know, fits right in, and also, somewhat of a pipeline, you know, out of Malvern Prep. I really like his game and kind of where it's going. You know, a very, very strong class at Malvern Prep in the 21s.
And then finally, Fisher Finley, a midfielder from Atlanta, going to Notre Dame. You mentioned a little guy. Finley is the opposite at about 6'5", 200 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, he dwarfs just about anybody, and you always thought that he had the kind of, you know, size and he's the kind of athlete that an ACC would covet, and that rang true with his Notre Dame commitment. The Irish loved him, and I think that, you know, at 6'4", 6'5", even though he's coming off of a major knee injury, I think he's someone that I can see having a really big summer because he's just starting to figure it out, you know, from a lacrosse standpoint. A really impressive middie that we had at Midnight Mania, and then I got to watch a substantial amount, you know, throughout the summer. I think he can play, you know, offense or defense potentially. But, yeah, I mean, just loads of upside.
Well, Ty, that'll do it for this edition of the Owl Preps podcast. We got to head out to Troy Park in Elk Ridge, Maryland to check out the Mid-Atlantic Prospect Day. Make sure to hit up InsideLacrosse.com on Sunday and Monday for all of the evaluations and analysis coming away from that event. And then, of course, on the first weekend in November, we'll be back for Session 1 of the Fall Isle Invitational, in addition to more recruiting coverage from across the country. As always, make sure you check out InsideLacrosse.com/recruiting. Follow Ty on Twitter at Ty Zanders. Follow me at Terrence Foy. That's Terrence with one R. And then follow at IL Prep for all that you need to see and know in order to stay up to date on the world of lacrosse recruiting. And of course, make sure to check out publicrec.com/lacrosse to get 10% off some incredible looking sweatpants.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.